Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I will be your host for the next hour here on WFMU, freeform station of the nation from Jersey City, in that great state we call New Jersey. Thanks for being here. I've got a great show for you this evening. And what we're talking about is colonialism. Yes, colonialism. And there is a tech angle here. There is a digital tech angle here. And it's given away by the title of the book. This is a book by Ulysses Mejias and Nick Coldry. And the book is called Data Grab, The New Colonialism of Big Tech and How to Fight Back. We're going to hear that interview in just a moment. As you'll hear in the interview, The context here is that colonialism is, as the authors argue very persuasively in the book, colonialism is taking a new form. For several hundred years, we saw the European powers, Britain, France, Netherlands, Portugal, Spain, all in various ways take over and establish colonies all around the world using various practices, which we'll touch on this in the interview. But the concept of the book is that colonialism, in a way, it never fully left, and it has evolved or morphed into what the authors call the new colonialism, and the new colonialists are not primarily nation states like they were a couple or several hundred years ago. Now, for the most part, they are companies located on the West Coast of the United States. And you know which companies I'm talking about. These are the big tech companies that I warn everyone about week to week. And these are, in fact, the new colonialists. And what's interesting and I guess disturbing as you go through the book is you learn how close the parallels are. They're not doing exactly the same thing as traditional colonialist powers, but their actions have some striking parallels. And the territories that are being colonized, since there's no new geography to be colonized, the colonization is now of us, of our data, of our lives, at the hands of these rapacious companies. And so this is a very important conversation. It's an important book, and I think it makes a vitally important and accurate point about the activities and the future plans of these big tech companies, the designs they have on your life. And we can learn a lot by studying what the traditional colonialists did to really understand what's going on in the boardrooms and in the senior leadership suites of big tech companies today. So I'm very happy to present this interview to you. If you'd like to join in the live listener chat, go to WFMU.org, click playlist and comments. Or you, in the future, if you're listening to an archive or podcast, you can go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic. .fm and find the playlist for May 6, 2024. Let's go ahead and listen now to my interview with the authors of Data Grab here on Tectonic on WFMU. Ulysses Mejias and Nick Coldry, welcome to Tectonic.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark.
The two of you have written an important book that I'm happy to talk with both of you about, Data Grab, The New Colonialism of Big Tech and How to Fight Back. At the beginning of the book, you discuss the similarities between the predatory nature of big tech companies and the violent behavior of colonial organizations like the East India Company and others. You're not arguing that these are the same, just that there are parallels. How do you explain those similarities?
Yes, well, thank you very much for inviting us. I think what Nick and I are trying to say in our work, in this book, Datagrav, as well as our previous book, The Costs of Connection, is that the best way to understand what's happening with data in our societies is to look not just at the past 50 years, let's say, of internet history and the development of digital mobile devices, but to try to look at it in a larger historical context, in a context of 500 years of colonialism and of extraction. And so that's why we've come up with this concept of data colonialism, which might seem a little bit weird to put those two words together. Data obviously refers to something of the present, of the future, and colonialism obviously, which refers to something of the past with a long history. So how do we, or why do we put those two words together?
And I think the key thing we're saying is a lot more than just another capitalist innovation, yet another technique for extracting the juice out of assets. Of course, that's been going on for the past 200 years in capitalism. What's happening is much more dramatic than that. And that doesn't really fit within our accounts of capitalism, which is that it's a new grab of a new type of asset that's never been taken before, and in fact, could never have been taken until around 30 years ago when the internet started to fire up and be part of everyone's life, which is human life, seized by the fact that we all carry devices which keep us online most of the time. And when we're online, it's tracked. Data is grabbed from that, and that creates a massive asset which is useful to business, because through that you can target people for advertisers, which is where most of the money is that's driving most of the internet. That's just one example of it, but it's the key way in which this new data grab is possible. And when you look at that in wide historical context, there haven't been many times in history when something that big could suddenly just be taken. And that is what has happened. That is the core of what has happened in the past 30 years. And we think, frankly, the only real historical comparison to that is going back around 500 years ago, when suddenly Spain and Portugal, two mid-sized European powers, found, wow, the Americas are there. We could grab them. We could take all their assets and no one's going to stop us, because we're going to tell them this is the way the world's going to work out better. And that is what happened. That's the sort of parallel we're making point to point between now, this early stage of big tech, the first 10, 20, 30 years, and the first 10, 20, 30 years of historic colonialism, whose echoes we're still dealing with today in the 21st century.
Yeah, I like how you wrote this in a very pithy statement that, quote, we've gone from a land grab to a data grab. I thought that was a nice way of summarizing the thesis of the book, that the acts of historical colonialism are being mirrored. Again, not repeated exactly, but they rhyme in the acts of predatory data colonialism, as you put it. Early in the book, you list, as you call them, six important similarities between historical colonialism and data colonialism. It starts with the appropriation of the world's resources. As you just said, you know, Spain and Portugal see the Americas and they decide to appropriate the world's resources. And I know colonialism did not only affect the Americas, but, you know, so there's that example. And then if we look at today, the data that we're all throwing off as we go about our lives, you make this point repeatedly in the book that the resource that's being grabbed is the data that comes off of our daily lives. It's a very intimate resource that these companies are appropriating. Further than that, I would also point out, you cover this in the book, and I've covered it on this show when we're speaking about appropriation of the world's resources, the sheer amount of electricity and water that the new data centers are sucking down. So it's not simply this resource. Some people may think, well, is my personal data really a resource? It is, but I want you to add to that the very physical resources that are affecting the environment in order to run the data centers that are full of the surveillance data that got taken out of our daily lives. And that's just the first of the six similarities.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes, as Nick was saying, you know, we do have this new resource data that is fairly, that's coming to existence fairly recently. But as you're suggesting, Mark, we're trying to put this process of accumulation of dispossession in a much longer historical context. So that's why we go back, you know, to the beginnings of colonialism. So our official definition of data colonialism is basically that is this new emerging order for the continuous appropriation of human life through this medium of data for one purpose only, which is to create, to generate wealth, which, as you say, has all sorts of consequences to our social worlds and to our environmental worlds as well.
But at the same time, as you said, that there are these side effects. So clearly, the original colonizers didn't intend to trash the earth. That wasn't their goal. Their goal was to take the gold, to take the silver. They were quite happy to trash human bodies in the process. And equally, they didn't care that much about the environmental damage. They were less aware of it than we are today. But that's what they did. And equally, it's not the goal of Mark Zuckerberg, for example, to get incredible electricity bills, heat up the planet, cause the use of water to cool down the data centers and so on. That isn't his goal. His goal is to extract value and to boost the share price. But this is the inevitable side effect. In other words, we're saying just as historical colonialism proved that it really wasn't sustainable, it's at the core of a lot of the damage we're dealing with in the problem of our unsustainable climate emergency today. So this new data colonialism will not be sustainable, and it will add to the environmental costs, which are the long tailwind of historical colonialism. So these things merge, these perspectives merge in a sort of bigger hit that is building, which will be super colonial, if you like. Original colonialism and data colonialism merging over time into a reinforcement of the colonial damage.
That's right. And you do make the point in the book that the people most affected by today's data colonialism tend to be the same communities, the same populations of people who were affected by historical colonialism. As you write, the profound injustices of historical colonialism, theft, slavery, discrimination, far from being superseded by the new injustices of data colonialism, are made worse by them. So it's not just that our new age of data colonialism is unjust and predatory in some abstract way, just like the old times were. There really is an explicit connection between those two ages.
Precisely. I think, you know, we're saying that the effects of data colonialism are compounded by the legacy of previous forms of colonialism that still shape our lives up to today. So we're saying that even though we might all consider ourselves subjects in this new form of colonialism, the costs of data colonialism are not evenly distributed. Some populations, which have always paid a heavy price, continue to do so through these new forms of appropriation and extraction. So in terms of environmental impact, in terms of wages, through gig work, instead of having a regular contract, immigrants might be forced to work as temporary workers in the gig economy.
That's definitely true, but we're also adding an even more frightening perspective, which is that, if you like, the width of the colonialism's blade, the way it can cut through the social world, has been broadened by data. Because now, if you're an Amazon warehouse worker, you may well be working in the United States in a global North country. You'll be working class, probably, but you may be white. But the way you will be surveilled bears relations to few previous workplaces, except perhaps the colonial slave plantation, where surveillance was absolute and total. But as we know, and as unions around the world are starting to protest now in all over the world, the way those workers are treated, because there's no limit to the data you can extract from a body, there's no limit to the power that a manager can now exercise from you. In the past, there were some physical limits because the manager only had so many eyes and could run only so fast, et cetera, et cetera. There's no limit to how much Amazon's management team can surveil its workers. And that's true in these micro gig platforms that Ulysses was just working. So the inequality continues and is broadly colonial in shape. But the blade that's being wielded now by power across the world is broader, and it has a wider set of potential targets. And that's another reason why we really have to be paying attention to this.
And yet another similarity between historical colonialism and data colonialism. You write, predatory acts of colonialism have always had to be disguised by more positive, quote-unquote, civilizing narratives or alibis. And just as that happened in the old days with historical colonialists, now again we're seeing companies like Facebook, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, and others construct civilizing narratives to convince us that this is now the way the world works and it's going to be great and there's no need to resist it because it's inevitable. You write three civilizing narratives that we are fed day to day by these big tech companies. Civilizing narrative number one, everyone wants an easier life, aka, as you write, data extraction as convenience. Civilizing narrative number two, this is how we connect. In other words, we're just connecting with one another, as Mark Zuckerberg has always put it. And finally, civilizing narrative number three, AI is smarter than humans. In other words, don't even try to resist because our machines are going to outthink you at every turn. So with those civilizing narratives or alibis, as you call them, how should we think about what these companies are feeding to us?
Well, maybe we should just step back two or three centuries. And, you know, as an English guy, I can speak with some authority maybe about what English philosophers were making of colonialism. And people like John Locke, who have had enormous influence on the American Revolution, his philosophy of property and so on, he was arguing that basically he found the Catholic Spanish-Portuguese defense of colonialism a little unconvincing because it depended on the power of Christianity to convert people. And he had some doubts whether that was the best argument. Instead, he came up with an economic argument for colonialism, which was that the West, Britain and France in particular, had the smartest way of making the best use of the land. And the indigenous people just didn't know what they were doing. They weren't making the best use of the land. So in order to rescue the land and rescue the economic potential of it, you needed colonizers to take it over. And this was, of course, a great story as people took over land in North America and so on, but not just North America. So today we're told that we're going to waste this wonderful asset of data that we naturally give off, it seems, when we hang out on platforms, but there is someone who can rescue that, and that's the corporation. The only thing that's something very weird about that story, it's a little fairy tale that's completely upside down, because the only reason that data is naturally extracted from us is because platforms, we call them in the book data territories, have been created exactly for that purpose. Exactly so that there's nothing we can do that won't generate data that will be captured by the platform. So the idea that this is somehow natural and that we need to somehow fix the situation and put profit in the hands of corporations is exactly mistaking, you know, the goal of the whole thing for some accidental outcome. It's completely upside down.
Yeah, it was always true that in order to justify the barbaric colonialism, you needed these stories, you needed these narratives. And the colonized were told, listen, this might be a difficult pill to swallow, but at the end of the day, we're bringing progress. We're bringing modernity. We're bringing salvation even, because now, you know, the colonized used to, you know, follow barbaric rituals. And so now you have true, authentic European Western religion. So we were presented with those stories. Obviously, as you said, Mark, those stories have changed. So today, hopefully nobody's arguing that, by using these technologies, our souls will be saved. Although sometimes, if you read closely to some of the pronouncements some people in Silicon Valley make, they're getting close to that.
This is yet another similarity because the tech bros in Silicon Valley are literally talking about salvation of souls through transhumanist technology. At some point, we're all
Exactly.
going to upload our brains into the cloud, and then we're going to live forever. It's a strange echo of the salvation narrative that if you adopt this, you're going to achieve eternal life.
True. Yes, and even if we listen to how people talk about the singularity, and there is this ethos of the sublime that, yes, just by embracing these technologies, we are going to arrive to this, better world, which is the third point that you mentioned, right? The point about AI. We are told that humans have basically run out of mental and creative capacity to fix the problems, parentheses, the problems that corporations by and large have created for the past few hundred years. And so that now we need a bigger, smarter force, intellectual force to help us do that. And that is, of course, AI. So through the simple act of surrendering my data, I'm contributing to this process. So you're right, it sounds very much like a salvation narrative. I'm contributing to this process through which AI will become smarter and solve our environmental problems, our political problems, and our economic problems. And in the process, life is going to be made more convenient, and we're going to have more, a better sense of a global community because we will all be participating in these platforms that democratize communication, etc., which obviously by now we know it doesn't always work out that neatly.
Yeah, Sam Altman has said the potential of these new AI models is extraordinary, as he says. And he goes on to say that solving climate change is going to be easy once we turn everything over to his products that he's monetizing. Mark Zuckerberg has said that AI could allow his team to cure all disease. I mean, the scope of what these guys are always promising is breathtaking. And as you say, what they never seem to mention is what is so glaringly obvious to those of us observing, which is that the problem of climate change is being accelerated by the work of Sam Altman and the other tech bros. There are communities that are running out of water because the water is being diverted to the data center, which is full of the surveillance data that is generating wealth for that minuscule class of tech barons on the West Coast. So I find it a very compelling case that you're making in this book that we have seen this before. And now in the 2020s, I can't say that historical colonialism has that great of a reputation. So it makes you wonder, what are future generations going to say about this moment as the tech barons were surveilling us all within an inch of our lives and heating up the planet in order to increase the wealth gap in our contemporary moment?
Well, that would be a really bad outcome, wouldn't it? Not only do we mess things up a second time, but it's clear that we messed it up with the knowledge of how things were messed up the first time and ignored that history. And that's one of the key lessons of the book. Just to go back to that thing about electricity, I lived for a long time in West London, fairly privileged part of the planet, there's no doubt about it. But I read in the Financial Times just a year ago that there will be no further houses being planned until 2035 in an area with a housing shortage because there is no projected electricity to be available until after 2035. Why? Because the data centers have taken all of it. They've taken all that projected electricity. They're also taking a lot of the water, and there's also a water problem in West London, too. Now, this is an astonishing example of how our daily conditions of existence are being affected by this apparently so abstract and immaterial form of power that people can inspire us with, but it's directly affecting our conditions of life all over the planet, particularly in the global south. There's no doubt about that, but even in the global north, too.
Yeah, I read somewhere that Ireland you probably know more about this than I do, Nick, but Ireland 15 years ago was being praised as this new innovation center. They're doing all these deals with Apple and other technology companies. And so the partnership between Ireland and the Silicon Valley companies has grown and grown to the point where Ireland is now devoting a huge amount of all of its electricity to service the data centers for a few companies based in Northern California.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing it everywhere. In upstate New York, where I live, I think it's being identified as a very fruitful zone for data centers and microchip factories, because global warming is not going to affect it as badly as other parts of the world. And we have plenty of water in the forms of two Great Lakes. Microchip companies are already planning to move in because, you know, running a microchip factory in Texas might be too taxing to the environment. But in New York, it might be a little bit easier. And they are looking at land that's owned currently by First Nations. So it's almost beyond belief that we can just see the process again unfolding before our very eyes.
And you mentioned Sam Altman. He said an astonishing thing about 2 months ago when he'd been restored to OpenAI, which was that he needed $7 trillion from the markets. Okay. I know there's some deep pockets, but $7 trillion is equivalent to the entire economies of France and Germany. So imagine what the economies of France and Germany could be doing to combat climate change, to deal with the climate disaster, deal with inequality, you name it. But no, let's put that into this undefined zone of AI that will civilize us in some way, yet to be defined, but will certainly benefit Sam Altman in a considerable way. It's a crazy redistribution of resources coming without any democratic consultation.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Ulysses Mejias and Nick Coldry, authors of the new book, Data Grab, The New Colonialism of Big Tech and How to Fight Back. We're going to hear a little bit more about that data colonialism. And then before the end of the interview, I promise, there's going to be a little bit about fighting back. So you won't want to miss that. Stay tuned. If you want to join in the live listener chat, go to WFMU.org, click playlist and comments, and you can add your two cents there or just read what others have posted and also see the links that I've posted to the book and some images on the playlist that are there for your visual enjoyment. Let's go back to the interview now with the authors of Data Grab here on Tectonic on WFMU. You bring up an important point in the book, which is that you're not against technology or data per se. This is not a complaint against the technology in the abstract. You write, it's not that data itself is bad. The issue here is how data is extracted, from what, from whom, and on what terms. And similarly, elsewhere in the book, you talk about the scientific method that was part of historical colonialism. You state that you're not somehow against the scientific method and many of the advances that that's brought about. It's rather the system in which these things are employed and the ends to which they are deployed. Are we using the scientific method? Are we using data in order to stifle people's growth, exploit them, and concentrate power in a tiny group of people? Or, as some other people out there are trying to do, are we using technology and our resources in order to help people and to grow communities and to encourage democracy and better long-term outcomes like that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We're not saying we're against data. We're not saying that the data is bad. I mean, I consult the weather report every day, and so I'm using data to sort of plan my day and predict what the weather is going to do on a particular day. But I think both Nick and I are interested in social systems, how these technologies are used, how they are applied. I mean, I spend a long time with my students just debating the question of whether technology is neutral, because they think, yes, you know, if I can use it for this purpose and I can use it for that other purpose, then it means technology is neutral, which is, strictly speaking, true. But technology is never neutral in the sense that it's always embedded in social systems. As soon as technology is interacting with humans and humans are interacting with technology, it is never neutral. And so we can say the same thing about science and the scientific method. Of course, the scientific method is a wonderful thing. But if you're using the scientific method in a research study paid for by corporations, guess what? Your results are not going to be neutral or unbiased. So that's kind of the point that we're trying to make, that data is never neutral. It's always being used for very specific purposes. And as we're discussing, it matters a lot what the people who have control to these enormous resources, what they say we should be using data for, and who benefits from that application.
Yeah, and I think, again, if we just push it onto one concept we introduced in the book, was that of the data territory. I mean, obviously, colonialism was based on physical territories, which gave a sort of tremendous control to the colonizer over what could go on there. Today, we're not talking about land being taken in the same way. That land has been parceled off a long time ago. But we're talking about these new territories, which have to be created by writing code, which is the data territory, where you're online, you think you're buying something, or you're trying to get an insurance contract, or you're chatting with your friends, or sending them a nice picture of what you just did. But of course, everything you do is necessarily being tracked and captured. There's no way it can happen unless it's captured. That's the basic precondition of the platform. And it needn't be that way. Yes, of course, computers at some level are tracking what we do so that when we type on the keyboard, the words don't disappear into the ether. That could just be for your use. It could be for the use device only, on your device. But no, that's not the way the system works, because money is extracted by allowing extraction to happen between computers. And it has been for 30 years, but it's accelerated a lot. And that's what leads to the data grab of AI itself, if you like, taking the whole input of human history, which is just there for the taking online, and grabbing it as an input to something very specific, which is a large language model, which a particular corporation will make money out of, whether it's Google or whether it's OpenAI or whatever. An astonishing possibility. None of us thought that 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when we were just typing a blog online or doing a social media post or searching for something or any of this, that somehow that was capturable by some megacorp that didn't yet exist. But that's the world we were building. And that truly is a data grab without precedent almost in history, because it's almost operating outside time and outside space, taking the whole lot, but in a defined way that will make a defined amount of profit and is fueling a huge speculation bubble at the moment, unless as citizens we come together and say, no, we're not going to agree to this.
There's one arena you talk about where citizens should have more power, but so far they don't, and that's educational technology or ed tech. Platforms like Google Classroom are very popular. Millions of American students are forced to use this. And you write about how platforms, or as you say, data territories like Google Classroom, are built as surveillance machines. Yes, they provide some sort of framework for teachers and schools to manage grades and curriculums and things, but really they're built to harvest students' data and render that into some sort of wealth for Google. And you point out that there's a contract between Google and the school system that says, we are going to harvest your students' data. Now, there's no way for anyone to renegotiate that contract with Google, at least not within the school. So a teacher may be forced to use Google Classroom. They can't negotiate with Google. Parents definitely are unable to negotiate the surveillance of their own children by Google. And as you point out in the book, the voice of students is completely absent from the discussion. So the human beings who are most vulnerable are least empowered to do anything about the situation.
Very true. And, you know, I mean, I teach in a school system, the State University of New York, where we went through all of this 10 years ago. As budgets kept getting cut, it was decided that the school should use Google for its IT services. So instead of the university providing email servers, we would just use Google. At that time, I tried to raise a red flag and say, well, let's think about the consequences. But of course, you know, it always boils down to this issue of money. When you cut budgets to education again and again, you leave schools no choice but to open the door to Google and Microsoft and all of them. And of course, at that time, I was told, well, we're going to use Gmail for email, but you won't see any ads. So then it's okay because, you know, it's not being commercialized that way. Of course, we now know that the ads were the least of it. The capturing of all of our emails and of all of our documents on Google Drive and using all of this data to train AI systems or to just build better profiles of how to market things to people, that was really what was at stake with ed tech.
And we also have to look into the future because, as you say, education is a really important case study in the book and generally, and one that affects everyone, but is often not being talked about at all, except to celebrate it. But if you look at what's going on for the future, this is subtly going to change the status of the teacher in the classroom, the human body that stands up in front of a group of kids and tries to convince them that somehow they embody knowledge. That's why they're being paid to stand up in front of them. We know that they're already subtly being undermined and have been for 10 years by these edtech platforms that basically run the curriculum, host the assignments, manage the marking grading process online on a system that we know the teacher doesn't control and the kids know that. But supposing we live in societies where in 5 years, it's moved fast enough in 1 year, ChatGPT becomes the de facto source of all wisdom on any question you might like to ask. Well, if that happens, you've got to ask whether in 5 or 10, let alone 20 years' time, kids will even make sense of the idea of going to a building where particular bodies are standing up claiming that they represent knowledge when they can get this much better version of the same knowledge from AI that's processing something that the whole humanity has been saying for the past 10 or 20 years through a little device they hold in their hand and that costs them nothing and costs their parents nothing. We've really got to raise questions, not just about the changes happening right now, but the implications for the future. We're literally redefining what counts as knowledge in our societies today.
All right. So we've talked about, as the subtitle says, the new colonialism of big tech. Now let's go to the second part of the subtitle, which is, and how to fight back. You have two chapters at the end talking about voices of defiance, as you put it, and then a playbook for resistance. Many of my interviews on this show end with this question, what do we do now? I'm happy to say you go into some depth in these two chapters talking about people who have written and acted in resistance to past colonial regimes. And so there's a body of knowledge that you're drawing on to encourage us to resist in those ways, those time-tested ways. What are some of the ways that if we want to resist, we should be acting?
It's true that, I mean, when we talk about data colonialism, a lot of people get overwhelmed and depressed because if we are putting this problem in the context of 500 years, what are the chances that we're going to be able to solve it quickly or efficiently? But it's true that at the same time, whenever we presented our work, especially to audiences in the Global South, it does motivate them in new ways because colonialism is something they understand. And they also understand that there have been people resisting colonialism for centuries. Now, maybe it's not something that colonialism was completely overthrown and new ways of life were imagined at a large scale, although they were at a smaller scale, always here and there. So that's what we try to focus on in the book. How have individuals, how have communities resisted? And can we learn from them how to resist? So we actually get some lessons from activists in Latin America and elsewhere who have said, listen, this is going to have to be a multifaceted solution to a multifaceted problem. So you cannot just do single actions here and there. You need to think systematically about how to confront this. And these activists tell us that that means acting at three levels within the system, acting literally within the system, then acting against the system, and also acting beyond the system. So within the system, it might mean, traditional politics, forcing our governments to pass regulations that actually benefit us, not corporations. At the same time, we cannot expect the system to fix itself. So we also need to act against the system through various forms of protest. And we have seen lots of examples of that as well. And maybe Nick can talk about what it might mean to act beyond the system.
Beyond the system is obviously difficult because the message of the book is this system is big. This is a whole new social order that's being built around us. We're part of building it. We're entering these data relations every time we hang out on a platform or every time we load a new app on our phone. So we are part of building this social order. And that means we have to change something in ourselves. We need to change how we imagine the future. And this is where some of these thinkers you were mentioning that we talk about in the book come in, whether it's colonial resistors like Leanne Simpson, the Indigenous writer from Canada, who's written beautifully about the power of staying on the land, holding on to our ways of doing things, holding on to our time, our space, not giving all our time to being on platforms or apps or on our phone, holding on to what we know we can do. That's one way. And then there were the writers who saw along in computing the risk of a new, rather terrifying social order, putting much greater power into large corporations. So there are many writers who have written in the past. And just to name one more, Naomi Klein, we go back to the early days of the pandemic, which was, apart from being a terrifying time for all of us physically, mentally, was also seen by certain people in the big tech industry as a fantastic new opportunity. You may remember that in New York, Eric Schmidt was dancing up and down and saying to the mayor of New York, "This is the chance we must take to install AI-driven edtech platforms in every school, in every classroom." Naomi Klein was one of the very few voices to stand out, and she called this the Screen New Deal. This is going to grab our kids right now forever. And Eric Schmidt said this needs to be a permanent change just to take advantage of a short-term opportunity. But Naomi Klein speaks here with some authority because she's someone who's seen colonialism in action in the late 20th, early 21st century. She's seen the continuities and she spotted the continuity there. She was exactly right to see that colonial land grab just in his early stages in Eric Schmidt's very swift, very well prepared actions with Mayor of New York in the first days of the pandemic. Luckily, we didn't entirely move our schools online. We could well have moved to that entirely online education system, which would have locked in edtech for the rest of time in education. Luckily, we avoided that fate.
Yeah, these voices of resistance that you're drawing on and these recipes for action, I think, are a great framework for how we can try to resist the continuing incursion of big tech into our daily lives. I really believe that the very, very first step to any of this is people just gaining some basic awareness of what's happening, which is why I do the show And I think that's something that this book accomplishes beautifully. The book is Data Grab, The New Colonialism of Big Tech and How to Fight Back. It's published by the University of Chicago Press, written by my guests today, Ulysses Mejias and Nick Coldry. Ulysses and Nick, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having us. It's been great.
Thank you very much, Mark.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining 11 minutes of the show. And then Dave Mandel will come on with his show called It's Complicated. It's a prog rock show. After Dave Mandel, to whom no one holds a candle, we're going to hear from Amanda and Jim the Poet with their show Bad Animals. And then from then to midnight, it goes to Brother Daniel Blumen with his eponymous show. I hope you will stay tuned for those, because they are well worth listening to. I want to say thank you to Ulysses Mejias and Nick Coldry for speaking to me. They're the authors of the book Data Grab, The New Colonialism of Big Tech, and How to Fight Back, published by University of Chicago Press. And I was very taken with this argument, as you heard in the interview, that we are living in a new phase of colonialism. It's, as I said at the beginning, not that colonialism ever completely went away, but it has certainly changed. The day-to-day reality of colonialism looks different in many ways from historical colonialism from hundreds of years ago. The East India Company itself does not run colonial activities today, but many of the underlying motivations and processes are still very much at work on all of us. We are now the colonized. Although, as Ulysses and Nick pointed out, the effects of data colonialism fall harder on some populations than others. So that's worth pointing out. Many people around the globe who hundreds of years ago might have been the direct targets of historical colonialism are once again targeted for the worst effects of data colonialism. But whatever population or community you're in, you are a target. Unless, I suppose, you're one of the senior leaders or the senior lieutenants at these big tech companies, perhaps you can opt out of some of that because you're on the other side of the curtain. But everybody else is eventually going to be a target. The effects hit some people harder now, and they hit earlier to some people, but they will get to you at some point. I mentioned earlier the images that I put on the playlist. Sometimes they're fun, silly, topical. There's one that I thought was particularly relevant on the playlist this evening. It's some sort of a social media post. I don't know the actual user, but I enjoyed the sentiment in the post. It reads, "Dystopian fiction is when you take things that happen in real life to marginalized populations and apply them to people with privilege." So there's your dystopian fiction summary. And maybe that gives you a pattern for understanding or unlocking some of the processes that we're seeing in data colonialism. Because as I often say on the show, we are building a dystopia. We are building a surveillance dystopia. It's dystopian nonfiction, really, is what we're building. And what's happening is we are trying out new processes of exploitation on marginalized populations, and then we are slowly but surely rolling them out to more privileged populations. So this is all to say that this conversation around data colonialism, this is about you. This is going to affect you. It already is to some extent. It's maybe mostly hidden to most people listening to me right now, but it is affecting you, and it will affect you in more and more ways. So it's worth paying attention to what these big tech companies are doing. And as Ulysses and Nick said, there are ways to fight back within the system, against the system, and beyond the system. So if you're interested, you can grab a copy of Data Grab and check it out for yourself. I did put one article on the playlist that I thought was telling. This was after I finished reading the book. I guess I was just more attuned to these ideas of colonialism. The story appeared in the Wall Street Journal. This was from April 30, so just, I guess, a little over a week ago. And the headline is, Microsoft to invest $1.7 billion in AI infrastructure in Indonesia. And the pull quote is, Microsoft said the investment would help its goal of training 2.5 million people across the region in AI skills. All right, so what we have is an almost $2 billion outlay from Microsoft in order to train, by their own estimation, 2.5 million people in Indonesia in what they vaguely call AI skills. Now, if you read the Wall Street Journal article, it doesn't go much further than just kind of quoting the Microsoft press release. It doesn't really kick the tires or ask any critical questions. But let me ask a critical question. Oh, what exactly do you mean by AI skills there, Microsoft? Because Microsoft, you know, it comes up frequently in this Data Grab book. They are one of the main practitioners of data colonialism today. They are one of the main colonizers of our data, of our lives. And they're saying that they're going to pay $2 billion. Do you think, let me just ask you, do you think that Microsoft is going to pay $2 billion to help people in Indonesia? What are the chances they're doing this with some sort of philanthropic impulse? Some saving the world impulse? No, no, no. They're training people on, as they say, AI skills. Well, if you look under the hood with many AI systems, what you see is not magic technology. What you see are exploited workers doing manual labor. This happens again and again and again. AI skills, especially in the global south, is quite often, not always, but quite often, it's exploited labor. So we have to ask, what does Microsoft want to do with the Indonesian people? What do they expect to get a return on $2 billion, $1.7 billion from the Indonesian economy? What exactly are they hoping to get in AI skills? That's something to ponder, friends. I could go on, but I'm just about out of time. I do appreciate your time and attention this evening. If you'd like to reach me, I'm at mark@wfmu.org. And again, you can find this and other episodes on the Tectonic website, tectonic.fm. And I just want to tell you right now, our outro that I'm going to play here in a moment was suggested to me by a friend of mine and a friend of yours, Wendy Del Formaggio. Sent this over. Thank you, Wendy. She's the host of Wreck Your Own Adventure, which is 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern on Mondays, just before this show. She's on the Give the Drummer radio stream here at WFMU. Fantastic show, which you should listen to. And she suggested an instrumental by a group called Rocket 808. And the name of the song is Under Surveillance. And we're going to listen to that just after I tell you that you're listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Until next time, friends, you know what to do. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, friends, get off Google. Have a great week.
Hey now, it's Monday, 7 p.m., meaning it's time for It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music presented by yours truly, Dave Mandel. I'm here every Monday evening, hot on the heels of the Tectonic Show, hosted by Mark Hurst. A pleasure to be here always playing music for you. And we're going to start tonight's show. I have a bunch of recent music to play. Well, I always play some recent music. I think I have a little bit more than usual this week, maybe. Recent meaning 21st century music. And we're going to start with a group from France called One Shot. This group features, we're going to hear a track from an album released in 2006. We're going to hear the title track, in fact, from the album, which is called Iwas Vader. And this band, One Shot, is mostly composed of former members of Magma. Magma, the towering French Zool group, the father, the grandfather of all Zool bands, Magma. I think it's a pretty young band, so I think the former Magma members in this group are recent. Magma has reformed, two or three times in the last 20 years. So these are not original members from the 70s, but more recent members. Anyway, One Shot's the name of the band. This is great. This is, again, the title track from the 2006 record, Iwas Vader.